It is Thursday, December 6, 2012. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Support for KUAF comes from the Rogers Historical Museum and its Winter Wonderland tours at the museum's 1895 Hawkins House. They run through December 31st. These tours explore how ancestors survived winter's weather and used it as inspiration in decorating their homes. Located on South 2nd Street in downtown Rogers, 621-1154 or rogersarkansas.com/museum.
The third annual Fayetteville Half Marathon is Sunday, beginning at 6:30 a.m. at the John McDonnell Outdoor Track Complex. The event features a half-distance marathon, a community fundraising 5K, and a one-mile fun-run walk. Registration and more information on the web at fayettevillehalf.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, bees in an Ozarks winter. We find out how the flying pollinators survive during the colder months. And Siloam Springs in Pictures. A new book collects images of the town.
First, yesterday we brought you news that the Fayetteville City Council had come to a consensus on where to build a parking deck in the city's downtown entertainment district. David Juergens is the city's manager of the project. He says the theater lot site at the southeast corner of the Walton Art Center campus offers distinct advantages over either of the other two sites considered.
If we built on the Walton Art Center lot, the big parking lot, we would, A, have to build a much larger structure to make up for all the parking spaces that we would take up with the footprint of the deck. And, B, we would lose the revenue that would be coming in from the parking in those spaces. And then, C, our customers, during the time of construction, would have many fewer spaces to park in. So a similar problem with the east lot, where we would be using up a parking lot that's used every day by paying customers.
Juergens says that construction on the theater lot site would be less disruptive to parking in the entertainment district than on either of the other considered sites. But he says future development potential is another reason the big Walton Art Center lot was not chosen as the site for the parking deck, as that lot is the largest undeveloped piece of property in the downtown area.
It seems that it would lose its potential if we took up half of that space with the parking deck. So if we could follow more of an infill methodology where we nestled the parking deck closer to where more people want it and not use up that large potential lot, then it leaves much more potential for us to do other type of growth in the area.
In addition, building on the east lot would have put the parking deck closer than comfortable to residences and businesses, and he says would have required additional land purchases by the city to make way for construction. Juergens says the next steps in making the parking deck a reality involve selling bonds to pay for the construction and working with architects on the final design.
The wait is over for country music fans as the lineup for the Thunder on the Mountain Music Festival was announced yesterday. Toby Keith and Luke Bryan will headline the event. The event is scheduled for June 6th through the 8th at Mulberry Mountain, just 1 week after the annual Wakarusa Music Festival. Other performers include Big and Rich, Montgomery Gentry, Gretchen Wilson, Colt Ford, Reckless Kelly, and Fayetteville favorite the Sarah Hughes Band. For the full lineup, visit the festival's website, thunderonthemountain.com.
Let's call those hogs.
Let's start this way.
That was the scene yesterday afternoon as Brett Bielema called the Hogs for the first time as the head football coach of the Razorbacks. In case you hadn't heard, Arkansas lured Bielema away from Wisconsin with a $3.2 million annual contract for a term of 6 years. The U of A athletic department held a press conference to introduce Bielema to the Arkansas public. But during the conference, Bielema said that while he grew up elsewhere, he has family ties to Arkansas.
I actually grew up in Illinois, but one of my favorite aunt and uncles grew up and lived in Little Rock, one of my favorite cousins. We only got to see him once or twice a year because they'd only come for Thanksgiving or the holidays. And actually, my aunt and uncle still live in Little Rock. I have a cousin that lives right here in Fayetteville, and it's going to be fun to rekindle with them. They used to bring us some Arkansas gear. I couldn't even tell you where Arkansas was when I was eight, but I was wearing that hat. It was a lot of fun and excited. With that, they introduced me first to what the fans of Arkansas are always about.
Bielema says that the first time that he witnessed the passion of Arkansas fans firsthand was during his first year as a head coach, when Wisconsin faced Arkansas in the Capital One Bowl. Coach Bielema says he experienced the fans' passion as he and his team received catcalls of Pig Suey throughout the bowl week back in 2007.
And yet he still came. Mostly cloudy tonight in northwest Arkansas, partly cloudy in the Arkansas River Valley. lows in the mid-40s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, 20% chance of rain. Highs in the lower 60s in northwest Arkansas, near 70 tomorrow for the Arkansas River Valley. Friday night, clouds, slight chance of rain and fog overnight in northwest Arkansas. Lows throughout the region tomorrow, lower to mid-40s. This is Ozarks at Large. The focus of Arkansas politics has shifted, at least for the moment, to Washington.
Governor Mike Beebe is hopeful officials in D.C. can arrive at an agreement on tax increases and federal spending cuts to avoid the fiscal cliff. The governor was back in Little Rock yesterday after meeting with President Obama, alongside other governors at the White House this week. The governor says everyone needs to share and sacrifice.
I think they're going to have a little bit of compromise of both plans. I think, and you know, the big thing is, I think they're already there from the standpoint of a realization now that you can't do it all with cuts and you can't do it all with increased taxes, that you got to have some combination. I think the Republicans acknowledge that. I think the Democrats acknowledge that. I think the Congress acknowledges it and the White House acknowledges it.
Given that sentiment, the governor says it should be easy for members of both parties to address the issues of taxes and spending before the December 31st deadline.
Fiscal cliff is not where we want to go. And so the message to both the White House and the Congress was compromise, get together, everybody's got to give a little bit, and let's get this thing worked out. Let's don't default.
The 90-minute meeting at the White House this week included five other governors of both parties, offering states' perspectives on negotiations.
Meanwhile, both of Arkansas's senators think they'll be in Washington until at least Christmas Eve to work on avoiding the fiscal cliff. Though some members of the House are expected to leave town next week, Senator Pryor says leaders of both parties in the Senate want colleagues to work on debt stabilization and debt reduction until the last possible moment before the holiday break.
The debt ceiling will be folded in to some end-of-the-year agreement, which will, I'm sure, include raising the debt ceiling at least for several months. I'm not quite sure how long. I mean, my guess is that we'll probably do one extension that will get us through at least a big part of next year.
Senator Bozeman says he thinks an agreement will be reached at some point and says he's confident the taxes on the middle class will not go up.
Everyone is committed to working in such a way that we reach agreement. And this is such a detrimental thing to the economy, the uncertainty of not knowing what your taxes are going to be in the future, you know, our businesses not being able to plan. And so, again, you know, the good news is I think despite, you know, what we read and things is that people really are working in good faith.
Both senators, by the way, are also working for passage of legislation that would call for a comprehensive energy review every 4 years. Senator Bozeman says that legislation is creating policy that would stimulate economic growth.
We have the ability now to use American-created energy and really could be energy independent. In 10 years. You can imagine if we quit sending hundreds of billions of dollars overseas, the effect that that would have on our economy, the number of jobs that would be created in the energy field.
Pryor says the review would also save taxpayers' dollars and lead to energy savings.
Though it doesn't really feel like it, it's wintertime. Bears hibernate. Humans wear layers. What do bugs do? In particular, bees. I decided to find out.
Don't know. Here comes another one. Let's see.
That's Dr. Don Steinkraus, an entomologist at the University of Arkansas. He is standing in front of a row of beehives at the off-campus research farm. On this sunny but windy day, he's surprised to see bees flying in and out of the hive.
This is actually really quite cool for it. I mean, it's windy. That one had pollen on its legs, though, and they're exceptionally good at finding a few flowers, even in like wintertime if they get a warm day. Dandelions sometimes bloom in like sunny little warmer pockets.
Americans typically keep European bees, bees from Italy, Germany, and Hungary, bees that are accustomed to this environment. Arkansas winters aren't really very harsh, especially this one. If there's a warm day, bees will come out in search of whatever pollen they can find.
They also do a thing called cleansing flights. Bees typically don't defecate in their hive. So on a warm day, they come out and they'll defecate outside of the hive. So they sort of hold it until they are able to get out on a warm day.
They can easily hold it for weeks on end. Further north, in places like Minnesota or Canada, where the winters are much colder, bees aren't able to get out of the hives as often or for very long. If it gets below 50 degrees, the bees want to cluster inside of the colony or beehive.
They don't hibernate, so they have this cluster. The colder it gets, the tighter the cluster of bees. Just like if you were really, really cold in your some unheated tent and you had other buddies there, if you got really cold, you might cluster together to warm each other up. So that's what they do. They warm up by hanging out in this ball, and they eat honey all winter long.
Honey is the fuel which runs the bee colony. A cold-blooded insect, bees use the honey to generate heat in their wing muscles. Vibrating them allows them to produce a small amount of heat per bee.
But when you add that up with, like, say, 30,000 bees in a cluster, that generates enough heat to keep the cluster warm, even if it's, like, minus 20 degrees outside.
30,000 bees fit into a hive that's about 3 feet tall, and not even that wide. It's enough to keep the internal temperature of the cluster at 60 to 90 degrees, depending on the outside temp.
And the bees on the outside of the cluster get cold, and they gradually move into the interior of the cluster, and other bees in the interior move to the outside, so they all keep somewhat warm all winter. So if you could stick a thermometer into the cluster of bees, it might be like 80 degrees even in the center of it.
There's a sort of safety in numbers thing going on here. If the cluster gets too small, the entire thing could die in a cold spell. To keep those numbers up, the bee colony overall must be healthy, especially the bees going into the winter generation. A summertime bee's lifespan is 40 to 50 days. A wintertime bee lives about 4 months.
So these bees are slightly different physiologically than the ones in the summer. But if the generation being produced in August and September, the new adult bees being produced then, is of poor quality, if they're diseased or if they've been fed on by mites too much or something, they may not be very healthy and they die early, and then the colony dwindles and you lose your colony.
Bees die every day, just like humans do.
I read the obituaries every day in the newspaper, and every day, you know, 5 or 10 people die in northwest Arkansas, and probably 5 or 10 more are born. And in the bee colony, though, in the wintertime, the queen's not active laying eggs very much, generally not until, like, January comes around. She'll start laying again. So they're having to depend upon overwintering from the adult bees in that group.
A problem right now is the weather. It's warm and the bees are active, getting out of the hive. But there aren't any floral sources out there. They're wasting energy looking for pollen that just isn't there. For beekeepers, it's important to make sure they have honey in the hive, or pollen pads, even sugar or corn syrup water, anything they can sustain themselves on. For non-beekeepers, if you see them around your hummingbird feeder, well, just let them be. Entire colonies can be lost. It used to be just 10% or so.
In the last decade or something, it's been closer, maybe 25-30% lost. And if you're a commercial beekeeper, that's a big loss. And that's why there's a lot of research going on right now to how can we minimize these losses. And they're due to many different factors. Lots of different little parasites which feed on the bees, and declines in pollen and nectar quality, and, you know, all kinds of things.
There are a number of things you can do to prepare bees for winter. As simple as removing excess honey, but making sure there's still enough. A 30,000 bee colony needs 20 to 30 pounds for a typical winter here. Beehives also need protection from predators.
Sometimes people put mouse guards across the bottom so mice won't get into the hive and damage it, which they will sometimes. They'll come in when the bees are in their cluster, and they can eat a few of the bees, and they can eat some honey and pollen and chew on the wax and cause a mess. They make the little nests in there. So usually people put a bee guard on.
They're cold and looking for food too.
Yes, that's right.
In this climate, we almost always have one day a week where the bees can fly, and keepers are able to keep a ventilation board on bottom all year long.
So the varroa mites and things will fall out and not get back on the bees, and also provide some ventilation. So you'd think that, you know, if you have an open bottom and it's really cold, it'd be really harmful for the bees, but they actually generally can do all right.
Prior to this interview, Stein Krause wasn't able to promise that we could look inside a hive. It's bad to mess with them too much, and you definitely don't want to let in the cold air. But as we've already mentioned, it's warm enough.
So let's open this hive and take a look,
okay?
And you don't have your suit zipped up, I hate to tell you. So they would fly right up inside of your hood.
Okay, well, please
and,
help. This is my first experience.
Yeah, you don't want them to fly.
This is my first experience.
You don't want them flying up into
your
hood.
No, I definitely don't want them in my hood.
No, normally.
I'm covering up my hands, too.
Normally when we open a beehive in the summertime or spring, we smoke the bees. And I'm not going to do that today. I'm just going to open up. We have our bee suits on. We should be protected pretty well. So I'm going to open up. We'll just look and see what they're doing, okay? So now, if you look here, here are some bees. Now, they're going to probably get really grumpy because they don't want to be opened up. And you can see they're still alive and active in here because today is a fairly warm day. And so you can... They're just doing their thing. They're eating a little honey, and a few of them are going out foraging. They're probably taking care of maybe a little bit of brood in there. I'm not certain about that. And if we open it up more, we'd see more and more bees. And so, any questions about that?
I don't know. I just got kind of scared all of a sudden.
Yeah, me too. Because we didn't smoke them. See, one's trying to sting me right now.
Dr. Don Steinkraus is an entomologist with the University of Arkansas. I visited the hives on the research farm earlier this week. For more information on raising your own bees, contact the U of A Agricultural Extension Service. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Ozarks at Large. On Wednesday morning, Dave Brubeck, one of the great American musicians, died. He was practically 92 years old. He would have been 92 the next day. Robert Ginsburg, who is the host of Shades of Jazz, which you can hear Friday nights and Saturday nights beginning at 10 on KUAF, is with me. It's hard to overstate Dave Brubeck's effect on American jazz over the last 50-plus years.
Absolutely true. And, you know, in no small way, Kyle, that impact was magnified by the fact that he did these college tours. And if you look at the vehicle for getting jazz out in the world these days, at least in this country, it's college radio.
Mm-hmm.
So that in itself, if had it not been for Dave Brubeck and the series of college recordings and tours that he did, the whole face of jazz could be different. That's just on a kind of a logistical level. Musically also, he was one of the very first integrated bands. He led an extraordinary life.
Was performing up right almost until the end.
Absolutely, right up until the end, yes.
He played in Fayetteville Walton Arts Center a few years ago.
Yes, and I was really honored and fortunate to have booked both of those concerts. The first one was the fifth season of the Walton Arts Center, and that was the first time I met Dave, picked him up at the airport, actually got to spend some time with him. His personality was absolutely a mirror of his music. It was joyous and exuberant, very giving guy. I'll never forget the first time I met him. I was driving him to the hotel, and I had some obscure Brazilian artist on the CD, and I quickly turned it down on the cassette player, actually. But here's this monumental artist, and he said, "Turn that up. Who is that?" I mean, he was totally inquisitive. He wanted to know all about what is this music I'm hearing, and so he was just that kind of guy. I have one other Brubeck anecdote that I'd love to share. He was at the Walton Arts Center about 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. That was the last time, and it was right before his 86th birthday, somewhere in there. I had had a catastrophic accident a few months earlier and broken my ankle, and I had this wire mechanism wired to my leg, and I was on crutches about to do the curtain speech. I was backstage with Dave, and we were talking, and he asked me what I had done. And we're both on the sidelines, and I'm waiting for the cue to go out and do the curtain speech. And I get the cue, and Dave turns to me, and he says, "Break a leg." So he had a great sense of humor. And just I also remember this, Kyle. That year, that concert, backstage, he had had a problem. He was taking one of his vitamins, and he had choked on it. And I had this image because he's about the same age as my mother. And he was a frail man, very slight build. And, you know, he looked like this elderly man that was just kind of holding it together. The moment he got behind the piano, Kyle,
a whole different story.
There was as if this aura began to glow and burn around him, and his back straightened out, and his energy just was. There's just no way to describe it. Anybody who saw him knows what I'm talking about. There's no doubt that music sustained this man.
You can't talk about Dave Brubeck without talking about the CD, well, the album when it came out, Time Out.
Thank you.
revolutionized so many different things, including who listened to jazz. This became a mainstream contemporary hit, and it's been the introduction for generations since.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Kyle. And it, what's interesting about it is, in some ways, it was groundbreaking. He was playing with time signatures. Mm-hmm. He wasn't doing the typical three, like, waltzes and you know, 4-4 time. He was doing 5-8 and 8-9, and, you know, and people responded to it. It was kind of a bridge between what everyone was used to and something really exciting and new. And Dave Brubeck was also the first jazz musician, to my knowledge, that was on the cover of Time magazine.
Yeah, it's hard to explain how popular he was once this came out.
Also, the band, it's worth mentioning that there's iconic characters that were spawned from this band, including, of course, Paul Desmond, who had this unique saxophone sound, and Joe Morello, who was one of the iconic drummers of all time. So, yeah, he will be missed, but luckily he has hundreds and hundreds of recordings, and he's really a part of our culture now. Dave Brubeck will live on, undoubtedly.
And his son still performs.
Several of his sons. Yeah. Darius, which I think Darius may be his oldest son, and they've appeared here in Fayetteville on several occasions as well. So
now you have shows this weekend, Saturday and Sunday night at 10. I imagine we'll be hearing some Brubeck.
Absolutely. Saturday night from 10 till 1 o'clock is the new Saturday edition of Shades of Jazz. I got my hands on an extraordinary four-hour interview interlaced with obscure pieces of Dave Brubeck's music that no one has ever heard. It was done by a guy named Fred Hall, who was a
legend in his own right.
Yes, he was. A West Coast radio man who got started in the 40s when he was in the Navy and created his own show, Swing Time. This show has interviews with hundreds of jazz icons. He did a four-part interview with Dave Brubeck, where he sits down with Dave and Dave's wife, Iola, and with Dave's manager, Russell Gloyd, and they talk about the music, and he plays excerpts and entire pieces. And I'm going to air that over the next 4 weeks on the Saturday edition of Shades of Jazz. For the next four Saturdays from 10 o'clock till 11 o'clock, you'll be able to hear that. I thought about doing a tribute myself, and I'm certainly going to play some of Dave's music, but it would be hard to outdo this interview music sequence done by Fred Hall. So
that'll be the next four Saturday nights beginning at 10.
Exactly.
And, of course, Shades of Jazz every Friday night and Saturday night beginning at 10.
That's it.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Kyle.
And we mark the passing of another beloved musical figure, a man known to many in this area. Brother Bill Clampett died yesterday morning. He was a frequent sight on stages here and around the state, playing bass guitar and providing vocals in Jed Clampett's band. He was Jed's brother. A gentleman with a deep appreciation of music and a deeper appreciation of family, friends, and fans. He'll be missed by many. This is Bill singing lead on the song Love Someone Like Me. It's from the live Jed Clampett CD that was recorded in December 1999 at Jose's on Dixon Street.
That dancing moon is on the water. Do you feel inclined romantically? Well, if you do, I think you ought to love someone like me. There ain't no place you should be going. Ain't no need for you to leave. It's a lover's night, the stars are showing. You need to love someone like me. Someone else might try and bind you, but my love will set you free. And if your heart has got a mind to, you need to love someone like me.
Funeral services for Bill Clampett will be Sunday afternoon at 2 in Monticello.
Years ago, Confederate General Thomas Hindman marched north through the rugged Boston Mountains at the head of 11,000 men and 22 cannons to attack Union troops at Cane Hill. Learning of another Union column approaching from Missouri, Hindman instead placed his men on a low, wooded hill near Prairie Grove Presbyterian Church. Savage fighting broke out on the Confederate right on December 7, 1862, as men of the Union Missouri Division charged and were cut to pieces by rebel gunfire. Confederate countercharges were in turn devastated by Yankee artillery. As the sun dropped low in the sky, the troops on Hyman's left were preparing to sweep the battered Federals from the field when cannon fire from the northwest announced Union reinforcements. To learn more about Arkansas history and the 150th anniversary of the American Civil War, visit ArkansasCivilWar150.com. The Arkansas Civil War Sesquicentennial Commission is an agency of the Department of Arkansas Heritage. I'm Mark Crist.
From the arrival of the first white settlers to the resurgent downtown efforts of the Main Street program in Siloam Springs, the history of that Benton County community is captured in pictures in the new book, Images of America, Siloam Springs. Arcadia Publishing found the right person to catalog Siloam's history, Don Warden, the director of the Siloam Springs Museum. And the book was completed, he says, as a museum project. Don will be signing copies of the book Saturday from 11 until 4 at the museum. As a preview of that event, we invited him to our studio to explain how he approached the assignment of preserving the history of Siloam Springs in images.
I guess I started with chapter titles. I pretty much have, from the time I've been there, have a good sense of the flow of it, of the town's history and how it should be divided up. Some of it's fairly obvious. You've got settlement and dealing with the Civil War. And, you know, in the case of Siloam Springs, there was a big change when the railroad arrived. So I had one chapter start at the arrival of the railroad. And another big change was when the bypass went in, or what was known as the bypass.
Right. You can date how long someone's lived here by what they call that.
Exactly. And what's now 412. And, you know, to a lot of people, yeah, they think of that as the main business street in town. And it is where there's a lot of activity taking place. And a lot of that is activity that used to be in the downtown. So, you know, of course, the big box stores, you know, couldn't build in the downtown. I mean, they've got to have the space that they need for their operation,
right.
But it totally transformed the downtown, and it's starting to pick up again now because of the Main Street program, and we are the town does have a Arkansas Main Street program now.
I love the pictures that dealt with the Arkansas Conference College building and the basketball teams, because this is a part of the Siloam Springs history that a lot of people don't know about.
Right. Well, and that college is the reason that College Street is called College Street. And so I kind of snuck that in there. But that was a college of the Methodist Conference of Arkansas. And they had hunted around the state for a place to have a college and had various problems in other locations. And then they came to Siloam Springs, and there was actually that school building was partially completed at that time. It had been a separate project for the school district, and these promoters had come in and said, well, we'll build you a school. But then they ran out of money, so then the Methodists came along and said, well, if you'll make us a deal on this building, we'll complete it and then open the college. And so that's how we came to have the state Methodist College. And so that was in operation from 1899 to 1917.
And those great pictures, there's one of a couple of the women's basketball teams
right.
from the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Those
yeah.
are great.
Yeah. They had men's and women's basketball.
Tennis.
Men's and women's tennis. And men's football. Track and field. We didn't have any pictures of track and field. In fact, I'm not sure if I included one of the football team, but anyway, they had football.
Well, that brings up, I'm sure it was harder not to find photographs to put in, but at 127 pages, there had to be some heartbreak what you left out.
Right, yeah. There was a lot more that I could have chosen, and it was, just kind of went through and, you know, picked out things that told basically the story we wanted to tell, and borrowed just a few pictures. Most of them are from the museum collection.
My favorite, my absolute favorite picture. And it's funny because it's on the same page as a picture of the KUOA radio station from years ago. But Eleanor Roosevelt on a train, a whistle stop tour, being interviewed. This is a magnificent picture.
Isn't it? It's a great quality picture and a great image. That was when KUOA was a pretty new station for Siloam Springs. Obviously, it had a longer history over here, or older history. But Eleanor Roosevelt coming through and Storm Whaley interviewing her. And it's a great picture.
It's just fantastic. As you said, you've been with the museum for a good amount of time. You know Siloam Springs history. Was there anything in researching, putting this together, that surprised you?
There were a few pictures that I didn't know we had.
Oh, really?
I didn't expect that. But there were a couple of them I ran into that, this is a neat picture. Neat picture. I haven't seen this before.
Conversely, is there something, boy, that would have been the Holy Grail that, I wish I had a picture of that, or I wish I had that image, but alas, it doesn't
just
exist?
Just the image doesn't exist?
Yeah.
One of the unfortunate parts of our history was that the town was at one time a sundown town, and there are no pictures that I know of that sign.
But suggesting certain people shouldn't be there after the sun goes down.
Right, and they were, those signs were at each entrance to the town is what I've been told, and, people vary a little bit in the wording they think it had, or if it was just images, or whatever. But that is a part of our history too. I do allude to it in the introduction to the book, but that's an image that we don't have that was was part of our story.
The picture of what was called the Lakeside Hotel.
Uh-huh.
I go by that building, in that part of town, and you see it. And I just kind of imagine what that must have been like at its heyday.
And it still is a hotel.
Right.
So it's, still in that operation. But, at one time it was, one of the few.
Right.
And it's our oldest building downtown. That's the thing I think people don't really think about so much now when they look at it is... it really does have an important part in our history, and built about 1881.
Yeah,
and it's almost as old as the town.
What's something that that many of us might not know about Siloam Springs that you could share?
You've hit on a few of those things. I think a lot of people don't think about Arkansas Conference College anymore, or that the Crown's our oldest building downtown. The second picture was in here when the downtown was dirt streets and poles down the middle of the street. That image is around some, so there's some people know about that, but just to think of, I guess the thing I would feel like that people most don't understand is the time depth in our town. You look at, as you're going through your everyday life and looking around at the way things are now, you think of that as just the way things always are.
Mm-hmm.
And, once you start looking into the history of the town and what I was able to bring out, in the book is that total time depth where you have, a totally different look for the town at a lot of times and a lot of different historical developments over time that, we don't really think about now in our everyday lives.
Well, here's a chance. Tell us about the Siloam Springs Museum. There are bound to be some people listening who haven't been there before.
Right. Well, we're still a small local history museum. We're currently at 112 North Maxwell and have exhibits that span the town's history, things that are in the book and some things that aren't, and we go a little bit into prehistory and museum exhibits. And we're hoping, well, that's not right. We're planning
right.
to move into a new building. We're not sure when, but the city has purchased the old post office as a new home for the museum. And so we're still looking forward to the work starting on that space and being able to move into it and have a lot more visible, a lot more visibility and more room to work with. And there'll be things that we can do in that space that we couldn't do in the current space.
Don Warden is the author of the new book, Images of America, Siloam Springs, and the director of the Siloam Springs Museum. He'll sign copies of the book Saturday at the museum in downtown Siloam Springs from 11 until 4. You can find out more about the museum at SiloamSpringsMuseum.com. And more book news, Allison Moore's new novel, Riders on the Orphan Train, follows two adolescents as they're boarded on a train in New York City and offered as potential adoptees in early 20th century America. The orphan trains operated in real life for 75 years. More than 250,000 children were dispersed in that time, many of them in Arkansas. We'll have a full-length conversation with Allison Moore tomorrow, but because her first area signing is tonight at the Fayetteville Public Library, here's a bit from our conversation this week about how she began this project.
In 1997, I was teaching creative writing at the University of Arizona, and one of my students, who happened to be from McPherson, Kansas, had just seen the PBS documentary that aired on the American Experience. And she said, "Have you ever heard of the orphan trains?" And I had not, but those two words just absolutely haunted me, and they stuck in my brain. And shortly thereafter, I met Phil Lancaster at the Kerrville Folk Festival, and I asked him the same question, and he had never heard of the trains either. We both came back to Fayetteville that summer. This was my first trip to Fayetteville. We got the PBS documentary, watched it, and were just shocked that we did not know about this huge migration of children.
A quarter of a million.
A quarter of a million over 76 years. They went to every single state in the United States. And we began with the idea, I knew I was going to write about it, but the idea of writing songs was something new for me. Certainly wasn't for Phil, but I had to go back to Arizona. We were collaborating on the phone. I sent him the short story, and the next thing he knows, he's being taken up to Springdale to meet Mary Ellen Johnson by a friend who fixed her copier and said, "You need to meet this woman up there. She's got something to do with these trains." So Phil walks in with a guitar, sings the song, Ezra's Lullaby, and everybody looks up and says, "That's Lee Nayling's story." Mm. And Lee Nayling was one of the people in the documentary. And Mary Ellen Johnson says to Phil, "Well, I need you on my train." They were doing a reenactment 3 days later where they took 21 children in period costume, put them on the train, the old Pullman cars that they use, and got on in Springdale and go down to Van Buren. So Phil calls me on the phone and says, "Guess what? I'm going to get to ride on an orphan train." And I said, "Not without me, you're not." So I wangled a frequent flyer pass and got back to Fayetteville. We got some period costumes, and we got on that train. And that was the first time we met actual orphan train riders and started to get to know them and hear their stories.
Allison Moore is the author of the new novel, Riders on the Orphan Train. She'll discuss the book tonight at 6 at the Fayetteville Public Library, and will be at the Springdale Public Library Saturday afternoon at 2, the Bella Vista Library Sunday afternoon at 3, and at the Paris Public Library December 11th at 7 p.m. We'll hear much more from her on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
It's time once again to dig into the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for an archived featured interview. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich frames for us the life of lawyer and political figure George Haley, a member of the Pioneer Six who integrated the University of Arkansas. George Haley is also the brother of noted author Alex Haley, both of whom have partial roots in Arkansas.
In the winter of 2006, the Pryor Center team traveled to Silver Spring, Maryland to film the oral history of then 81-year-old George Williford Boyce Haley at his home. Pryor Center Associate Director Scott Lunsford conducted the interview.
Mr. Ambassador, if I could have your name, your full name, and you could spell it for us, that'd be great.
My full name is George Williford Boyce Haley.
George Haley was groomed from birth to be educated. He was born in Henning, Tennessee in 1925 to Simon Haley, a Cornell-educated agriculture professor, and Bertha Haley, a music teacher. His family, including his older brother Alex, moved various times in pursuit of their teaching positions. One of George's favorite childhood memories was in central Oklahoma, a Christmas circa 1930. His mom had put out coffee and chocolate cake for Santa, and it had snowed overnight.
And Dad had gotten out and put some sleigh tracks on the roof, up to the chimney, you understand, to see Santa coming down the chimney.
Sadly, George's beloved mother passed away when he was in elementary school, a vivid experience which made him question God.
Why would he do that? I went down to my class after I got enough together on it, and I checked around, and nobody else's mother was dead.
His father remarried a college instructor who George described as authoritarian. Several more step-siblings were born, and the family settled near AM&N College in Pine Bluff in 1939. George Haley said growing up in black districts shielded him from white racism, but soon he was consumed by it.
Whites would expect you to get off the sidewalk, you understand, till they pass. The train, if you were going on the train, you sat where colored folks sat. That was a way of life.
He described sitting on the backs of buses or train compartments directly behind engines spewing noxious fumes, forcing riders to close windows, even on hot summer days. He became skilled in scouting colored sections and restaurants and colored restrooms. All schools and colleges were segregated, as were businesses. Long car trips had to be strategic. Certain towns with histories of race violence were to be avoided. And as he came of age, George Haley realized he had to comply with Jim Crow, because if he didn't, he placed himself and his family at risk. After graduating high school, George Haley was drafted, serving in the U.S. Army Corps. He did basic training at Fort Dix, New Jersey, later was dispatched to Williamsfield, Arizona, traveling by train. Of course, he and his Army buddies had to stop and eat. The restaurant posted no signs, so they sat down in a corner spot.
And a young white waitress came up to us and said, "I'm sorry, you soldiers can't eat here. All of us are fully uniformed, just out of basic training." These things happened. Here we were. You obediently got up, something in your system isn't right, but you obediently get up and go to the other part where the blacks are sitting.
Supposed to be.
Yeah. Within a very few minutes, another train had come in, on which there were some German prisoners under guard. And they were ushered into the white part of the restaurant from which we had just been asked to move.
The year was 1944, and although united against the Third Reich in Germany and fascist Japanese incursions, our nation remained pathologically divided by race. Time and again during the interview, George Haley expressed quiet outrage after being subjected to society's separate but equal rules, which he said were not at all equal. But he acknowledged the experiences forged a certain strength of character. He didn't talk much about his military career. He attained the rank of sergeant, but did elaborate on using the GI Bill to pursue a college education. He completed his undergraduate degree in history and political science in 3 years at Morehouse, a black college in Atlanta, graduating with high honors. There, George Haley said, he was taught that if he wanted things to change, he had to make them change. Among his classmates was Martin Luther King Jr. Accessing a postgraduate education in the South at the time was difficult, so certain black students started to sue all white universities for access. To avoid litigation, the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville took defensive measures.
The University of Arkansas decided to admit its first black, Silas Hunt.
Silas Herbert Hunt entered the University of Arkansas Law School in 1948, the first land-grant university in the South to integrate. At first barred from studying with white students or even using college restrooms, he attended one semester before contracting TB and dying a year later. Jackie Shropshire of Little Rock was next to be admitted, followed by Christopher Mercer, and then George Haley in 1949. Black law students were segregated in the classroom by a wooden rail and barred from studying in the law library.
It was two floors up. What we would have to do is to check out if we needed a book, and we could. We couldn't use the restroom. Somebody complained about our using the student restroom. So the beginning was that we used the dean's private restroom, which meant that we had to come through his office, get the key from his secretary, and go through his office to his restroom. Okay. That, of course, was not working too well because of a lot of things, not from our standpoint. But then it was decided that we would use the faculty restroom, which meant that we would go through the students' restroom to get into the faculty restroom. Just utterly ridiculous. But that's the kind of thing that happened.
George Haley stayed the course at the U of A, but not without intense trepidation.
George Howard and I were walking on the street by Razorback Hall. Football players were in there. And so it was a fairly mild day. They had the windows up. And so before we got to the dormitory, somebody inside said, "There come a couple of those nigger students." You understand? And so George Howard has he's really got a temper. What's going on? You understand? I said, "Listen," I said, "George, we are going to walk by as if we don't even know they're there in spite of all of that." You understand? So we did. Walked right on by. Well, when we got by, somebody threw a golf ball. And it bounced on the sidewalk. On the side, George's side, it just bounced on. And somebody said, "You missed him." And they laughed, you understand? I said, "George," I'm telling myself as well as him, I said, "We will continue walking. We're not going to run. We're just going to continue walking as we are."
As they walked away, the students tossed a Coke bottle that smashed nearby. Verbal and occasional physical insults were commonplace, George Haley said. Still, within 3 years, black students were allowed to live on campus, and George Haley achieved membership on the staff of the Arkansas Law Review. He graduated June 1952, and after passing the bar exam, he left the state behind, moving north to Kansas City to practice law and raise a family with his wife, Doris. Although he didn't discuss it on tape, Haley's firm, Stevens Jackson, is considered the architect of the landmark civil rights case Brown versus the Board of Education. After serving as deputy city attorney, George Haley was elected Kansas State Senator. He moved to Washington, D.C. in 1959, where he was appointed by the Nixon administration as chief counsel to the Federal Transit Administration. He went on to serve under six more presidents, including as general counsel and congressional liaison of the U.S. Information Agency, chairman of the Postal Rate Commission, and spent time overseas, most notably as U.S. envoy to Gambia. In 2003, the University of Arkansas awarded George Haley an honorary doctorate degree. But during the Pryor Center interview, 3 years later, George Haley spoke little of his 50 years in public service. Rather, time and again, he reflected on the intense bigotry he perennially had to face.
But in spite of all of these things, there is a different kind of let's say, awareness. First, you have to really be aware. I'm not suggesting that a lot of people, a lot of whites, are aware of this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You see, enough of them are that they still, in many instances, consider themselves superior as over against blacks. Now, when you come to how you feel, blacks feel about themselves, how I feel about me or my family, I certainly have not felt inferior. I'm not inferior by any means. I really feel sorry. I mean this seriously because of my religious feeling. Mm-hmm. I feel sorry for a white person who thinks he or she is superior because his skin is light. You understand?
Yes, sir.
Again, I deal with a Bible quote. If a man say he love God and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For how can he love God whom he hath not seen, and hateth his brother whom he hath seen?
George Haley's interviewer, Scott Lunsford, is white and has no compass for growing up black in the Deep South. Yet his considered responses throughout the nearly five-hour interview with Haley showed a rare capacity to be both empathetic yet scholarly. Scott Lunsford was also acutely aware of how much George Haley's been pressed to talk about his older brother Alex Haley, the popular author of Roots, the saga of an African-American family, and co-author of the autobiography of Malcolm X. So Lunsford saved that query for last.
I can say to you that all of Alex's life was not just that happy. You understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
He would come to little brother to certain kinds of, to get certain kinds of support. As I said, he was big brother. Mm-hmm. But the family actually pretty much depended on me for the support. Alex would say that. He would tell people, even after Roots. But I can tell you that we were very, very close.
Although it did not come up in the interview, Alex Haley was haunted till the end by allegations that he breached copyright laws, lifting sections from the book The Africans for Roots. One formal charge was reportedly dismissed. The other settled out of court. Alex Haley died in 1992. But his little brother, George Haley, now 88, continues to travel and speak about his life as a civil rights pioneer. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
For more history, visit priorcenter.uark.edu.
The KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway is Friday, December 14th. The drawing, your chance to win a gift from one of many generous KUAF underwriters. Participants include Adventure Subaru, Mason Creek Farm, Collier Drugstores, Lifestyles Car Wash, and more. Registration and details available on the web at KUAF.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Fort Smith, and Peter Pender.
Peter Pender, Arkansas.
Right.
Sounds
like a tongue twister.
It is a tongue twister.
It's southwest of Ozark.
Peter Pender. Mm-hmm. What's the story, I wonder?
I don't know.
Right? There's got to be a guy named Peter Pender.
There has to be.
Let's put that on the list.
Okay.
That's something we have to find out next week. Peter Pender.
Among many towns that we found.
If you had a business in Peter Pender, it would have to be selling pickled peppers, correct?
Right.
Okay.
I think so.
Peter Pender's pickled peppers. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
We'll be back together Sunday morning at 9.
Yes.
With Weekend Ozarks at Large. Antoinette Grajeda will be back with us, or back with me, tomorrow for a new edition. It's good to have everyone back in.
It is.
I'm over the flu. Antoinette has had her wisdom teeth out. You were healthy.
Knock
the whole
on wood
time.
I stay healthy.
Yes, we appreciate that. All right. Thanks so much for listening, and have a pleasant
Thursday.